The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to the Fargo Podcast with Jeremiah and Mike.
Oh, yeah?
A podcast dedicated to the FX television show Fargo.
He says, is this what you want?
And that, sir, is the sound of opportunity knocking.
So put that ice scraper down and enjoy the show.
There you go. Now you're seeing it. The inescapable reality. You're trapped.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike. My name is Jeremiah.
My name is Mike.
Hello, Mike. How are you doing, my friend?
Well, I'm of two minds. I either feel like I'm sitting in a prison cell eating mashed potatoes out of a box, or I'm at the state fair eating deep-fried Snickers. So it's a real disparity between the two, but I'm real torn as to which one I should take.
It's so hard, you know? It just depends on which reality you think is more likely for you, my friend. I don't know. Have you ever had a fried Snickers?
I've had deep-fried Oreos, so I definitely yes, ventured in that
too.
County fair territory of like deep-fried sweets. I haven't gone so far as a deep-fried Snickers bar, though I'm assuming it's delicious. Horrible for you, but delicious nevertheless.
Yeah, I do love Snickers ice cream bars, but I guess a fried Snickers would be pretty good. Yeah, I've done the fair thing just like everyone probably at some point in their life has done. And I've done some of the fried things. I think fried Twinkies, fried Oreos. I mean, you know, especially when you live in the Midwest, Mike, they fry everything. They just
absolutely calories don't count in the Midwest. We know this.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the same place that in one town has a Dairy Queen and a Tasty Freeze within it. Clearly, they don't really care about not to give offense too much to that region of the country, but I don't know if nutritional value is one of the biggest aspects looked upon with state fairs.
That's a very good point. I think I've actually seen programs on the Travel Channel about this exact subject, how, you know, the fair is an awesome place to get food that you normally would never put in your body because, well, it's because it is food that you would only get at the fair. So, yeah, I totally agree with that. And correct me if I'm wrong, you have not been accused of any kind of murders or money laundering or anything like that where you could potentially be getting free by a very powerful person that you know, people just cannot argue with. Is that correct?
Unless Jay and Jack count as very powerful people that you can't argue with, though people argue with us all the time, so I feel like that last part is not really valid.
It's a good point. So, yeah, I see maybe the fair. That looks more of your reality, sir.
Well, that's a fair comparison. Thank you, Jeremiah.
All right. Well, anyway, we are definitely we're here to talk a bit about the final episode, the finale for Fargo Season 3, Somebody to Love, Mike. Luckily, me and you have someone to love in our lives, which is always good. But yeah, Mike, I don't know what – I haven't had a chance to see what a lot of people online have been talking about because I've been crazy busy for the last 24 hours. But personally, myself, I really enjoyed this finale. I mean, I've had a lot of mixed feelings about this season, but I thought they did a nice job wrapping it up. And I am personally okay with the ambiguous ending because it fit the theme so nicely about – what we've been talking about overall is that even though we live in a more modern technology world, the idea of whether what is true and what is not true is still very relevant, and it just depends on what you personally believe. So I think by having it in this way was really nice. I'm very curious to see what you thought about it, but I totally co-sign on this particular finale. What about you?
So I'm going to refer to back what we said last episode when we said that, you know, compared to the other two seasons, the penultimate episode felt very different in that it was more contained. It had bigger character moments. It was, you know, I think there was furthering action, but it wasn't really building to a climax like those other two episodes did. And I could almost co-op the same type of analysis for this episode where, again, you know, we were going to this episode, just like the previous two Fargo seasons, saying that, you know, there will be sort of like a bittersweet ending. Some people will still die, but I think the good people, quote unquote, will live happily ever after, and it'll relatively wrap things up. This is a very, very different finale for Fargo, where it ends, as you said, on a complete open-ended question, which I don't think the fandom is used to. I think, you know, you're asking what the opinion of this episode was. I've been sort of scouring the internet in my research of this episode. I found very mixed opinions. Mm-hmm. I feel like the people who loved this season loved the episode. I feel like the people who didn't like this season didn't like the episode. And either way, I do feel like this episode is very emblematic and symbolic, as you mentioned, of this general tenet of the season, which is, I think Noah Hawley has sort of broken his own rule book a bit. And whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing is up to interpretation. But I think this is a great symbol of the fact that, you know, we will get our requisite Fargo shootouts. We'll see, you know, some of our main characters go down in this episode. But we're not going to have, you know, Gloria and Nathan go into the county fair happily ever after. They really left that ending ambiguous, which, going back to the Coen brothers' actual filmography that they're pulling this from, Noah Hawley is, the first two seasons definitely felt like the ending of a film like Fargo. This mm-hmm. ending felt much more like something like No Country for Old Men, where you really don't feel like things are resolved. You know, I'm going to spoil it a little bit. You have Anton Chigurh, you know, he's the big bad. He ends up killing Josh Brolin's character, ends up getting away pretty much scot-free. Tommy Lee Jones, who's supposed to be the sheriff that's hunting him down, has this big speech at the end about a dream that he had, and you're sort of left with a lot of, like, unresolved, unfulfilled feelings or just a general sense of confusion, and that's sort of where this episode left us as well. So I think it's stayed very true to what this season was. Whether or not you like that is, you know, your own jurisdiction. And it also felt like it was evoking other parts of the Coen brothers' canon that wasn't necessarily touched upon before in the previous two Fargo seasons.
Yeah, and I do feel like, though, we talked a lot about this, I think, this season in the podcast, is that it is something that I think Noah Hawley intentionally went into this season going to say, I've got to find ways to freshen things up and make things feel a little different, still keeping the look and the tone overall for the show, because I think that is important. I mean, especially like the look for me, like I want Fargo to continue to look as beautiful as it does, but I also do like the fact that it still had that certain tone, but they did change just enough to kind of make it feel a little fresh. Whether or not you liked what happened or not, that's totally up to, you know, the viewer, of course. Mm-hmm. I personally think overall it was just fine, and I do understand the struggles that he has by, you know, trying to make this third season work without being a complete disaster. And I feel like that, especially here in the second half, and ironically, after poor Ray had passed away, I really felt like we got some really, really excellent episodes outside of maybe the standalone with them, with Gloria's trip to L.A. I feel mm-hmm. like we got some really solid episodes that really dug a little bit deeper into some character development that I didn't know if we would ever get. And so they kind of, you know, satisfy that a little bit. I still would have liked them to go a little deeper with Gloria, of course, and Winnie, and I was kind of hoping for a little bit more there, yeah. Especially with Gloria, of course. That might be just more because of the fact that I just love Karen Coon, and I want to see her get the opportunity to shine as much as possible. But yeah, it would have been nice to still dig a little bit deeper with her, but I think maybe that's just, I have to just realize maybe that's just Gloria, and there's just only so much you can really say about her. Mm-hmm. But overall, yeah, I do think, though, that he had a tough challenge, and I still feel like he did. I think he stuck it fairly well.
Yeah, I agree. I really like this episode, too. And I completely co-sign your opinion that I would say overall, and I'm sure we're going to be giving our overall thoughts about the season as we move along here, point by point. But I would say this is probably my least favorite season of Fargo, but it's still great television. If mm-hmm. that makes sense. The bar is just super high that Fargo season 3 couldn't, they might have nicked right over the bar, or they might not have necessarily cleared it. And I think it's because, like you said, outside of that standalone LA episode, the first half of the season, I think we were still trying to figure out exactly what was going on, not necessarily with the plot, but with these characters. You know, I feel mm-hmm. like Fargo is all about the characters. And I feel like, as you said, it wasn't until the second half that we really got deep into those characters. And once we did, I really, really started to enjoy this season, and this episode is no different in my opinion. And I also want to set up at the top here, we're going to be talking a lot about Noah Hawley. I think throughout the course of this season, it's been debated as to what's going to happen with Fargo, with Noah Hawley running an entire other show. You know, he's divided a little creatively. I believe at the ATX panel this past couple weeks, I think he had said that he wasn't sure, you know, if he was inspired creatively, he'd come back with Fargo. I believe when it got closer to the finale premiere date, he actually did sort of give a loose deadline saying, you know, check back with me in a few years. I might be, you know, if we're going back again to this decision of who's going to come through the door, I might be the Varga in this case. I might be the pessimist and say that I don't necessarily think Fargo is going to come back, just because it's sort of like when Louie, another FX show, has sort of been on hiatus. I think it's a matter of, like, if the creator ends up getting an inspiration, they'll do another season. If not, it's not going to happen, which I actually think, you know, is a great symbol of just how fantastic networks like FX deal with these types of creators. They're not putting a stranglehold on them saying, like, you have to do 7 seasons. They're basically saying, like, hey, you put out great work. You do whatever you need to. And it also helps that Noah Hawley's putting out another show for FX instead of, you know, just going off and doing whatever. So I think we also want to watch this under the lens of a presumptive series finale of Fargo as well. I know that Fargo, I mean, it's submitted as a miniseries in the Emmys. I feel like while there are through lines, there really are self-contained stories within seasons. This definitely felt like the most separated from the other two seasons in a lot of ways. Mr. Wrench might have been the only thread back, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I feel like we can, through all of those lenses, we can really break down this really great finale.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be about the fact that there was no Salversons involved or anything like that. I don't necessarily need that kind of tie-in, but I think it did, you know, purposely feel quite a bit different than the other Fargo seasons, and it, you know, maybe it did not come across quite as well as we hoped to, but I, you know, it still worked, and I agree with you. I do think that he's got a really tough decision. He really has a tough decision because he's been able to get 3 seasons off that are still pretty solid, you know what I mean? And if he goes for another one, it could be a total disaster. And I don't blame him. I would want that. So unless he feels like he really has gold, then I will be there and ready to give it a shot. But if he doesn't feel that way, I do hope he doesn't just rush in. And I feel like he is not that type of creator. He's not the kind of showrunner who is going to just make something to be making it. I think he's got to feel like it's really going to work. And so I trust him.
And also, let's also realize that by the end of this episode, we're basically caught up to today. We jumped three months a couple of episodes ago, and we're like, okay, I guess that's our time jump. But then we jump forward 5 years in the last 15 minutes of this episode.
Right.
All of a sudden, we're in like 2016, 2017 territory. So unless Hawley either goes back further back from the 70s, maybe seeing like how a young Joe Bulo found his way into the into the mob industry, or unless we do a sort of like running parallel, this stuff is all happening at the same time as all the stuff in season 1, 2, or 3, there's not a lot of ground to cover. So I don't think Hawley did this on purpose. I've read a lot of interviews with him on this finale, and I think he was like, I just said 5 years later, I didn't even realize it would put us to where we are today. That might be him being cheeky, but now it seems like if we do put all 3 seasons on a timeline, we're spanning a good amount of territory that there aren't too many holes to really fill in more possibilities for story.
Yeah, exactly. And if you like to look at Fargo as part of that story in this big book of crime stories from the Midwest, you know, it really, that's in the 90s. So really outside of, it really has covered just about, at least, like you said, 2 or 3 decades now. So I think you're absolutely right. He's covered all the time. I mean, this is a perfect way to end it if that's what they wind up doing.
Yeah, absolutely. But that being said, we still have a really fun episode to break down. So much happened here. And again, yeah, like you said before, it really harkens back to the theme that they've been hammering home this entire season, which is, you know, not only the greed concept, which I do feel like is a through line throughout all 3 seasons of Fargo, but this idea of truth and whether a story could be true. We get some really fascinating showdowns here that we have been salivating waiting for. So I'm ready to dig into it like a nice deep fried Snickers bar.
Absolutely. So let's do that. The episode, of course, begins with Gloria typing up her letter of resignation, and she's going to get ready to churn that in. In the meantime, we get to see IRS agent Dollard. Sorry, that this name is just so funny. Goes through the Stussy Empire's real books. In the meantime, we see Emmett signing some papers for Varga, those papers that he's been needing Emmett to sign, which we do find out a little bit later on what all these papers had to do. And then once, of course, Burgle gets a phone call from the IRS and finds out what is going on, she removes that letter of resignation and gets ready to head out to meet up with him. Now, one of the questions I had right off the bat when we see this sequence of events, which they, of course, did another interesting way to do the title sequence there about the whole true story. I thought that was kind of nice how they had it with the typewriter and how it, they kind of like collaged together there. But the first question I had after seeing this quick sequence of events that happens right away is that, what do you think Gloria's plan was? She was obviously, she was fed up. I understand at this point she's ready to go, and I totally don't blame her. I would want to get out of the clutches of Chief Mo as fast as I could as well. Do you think she had ambitions to go right to work for Department of Homeland? Or, I mean, obviously that was something we don't find out that happens 5 years later, so who knows how much, you know, what she had done in between time. But I wonder, do you think she wanted to stay in law enforcement? Or do you think maybe at that point, maybe she was thinking about completely getting out of that altogether?
It's a big question mark to start the episode with this, right? Because how did we end the episode last time was, it seemed like, again, Gloria was getting her groove back. She's like, nobody recognizes me. You know, I feel invisible in this world. Winnie acknowledges her. The machine world acknowledges her. It seems like she's on top. I'm trying to think about if her resigning from the St. Cloud Police Department is her going out on top. Maybe she would strike out on her own to do her own sort of investigation. I'm not entirely sure if she would be moving on to the DHS as she does at the end. That's, and I will admit, again, as much as I loved this finale, there are some definitive question marks left up there, and I feel like I can provide answers to a few of them. This, unfortunately, is not one of them. I guess we might have to use our imaginations and say that, you know, maybe she just decides to move on despite her new boldened sense of self. She decides, you know what, it's best for me to move on, and it's Dollard who brings her back into the fold after all this.
Yeah, and here's, you're absolutely right. I asked a question that we really will never really know for sure the answer to, and I get that. I think, to me, it kind of felt like it tied in very a little bit with the end to me, because I got the feeling that, yes, she's now, you know, being recognized. We had that wonderful moment, like you said, with Winnie. And I think that's great for her. But in the end, though, she's still upset about the fact that basically that things happen that she – and I know she mentions it even in the episode, that things happen when she's talking to her son, Nathan, how there's things that happen in the world that we just never can explain and understand. And one of those things is the fact that people like Varga is still going to get off, you know, and that the truth doesn't come out the way it should. And I think for her, I feel like she was just so fed up with that part of it. Maybe more so than, I think she could deal with the whole Mo thing. Whatever, he's a schmuck. Okay. I think it's just the fact that she tries to do everything right, and yet still guys like Varga gets off. And that kind of then leads into this ambiguous ending we have too, where again, we don't know for sure, does he get off or does he go to jail? You know. So I think it fits very nicely with Gloria's mindset, is that this is a world that kind of can suck sometimes, and maybe just getting out of it would be better for her. But then again, 5 years later, she's still doing, you know, work that could lead her in that position. So it was just an interesting thought to think, wow, she's ready to go.
No, you make a good connection also to her talk that she has later with Nathan, where she basically tells him, you know, like, the world is going to be confusing and chaotic, but if you rely on the people that you love, those are the connections that are going to help you get you through. And maybe, again, we are extrapolating so much that might not be true whatsoever, but maybe she's thinking, like, this was a sign to me that I need to spend time with the people that I love. Clearly, I'm not being loved here. Maybe it's time for me to move on and spend time with my son. But then, of course, when you have LaRue Dollard calling and dropping the Varga name, it's clear she's drawn back in.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, and it would, I mean, no surprise. I mean, as soon as he called, of course, she's first confused, right? Like, where, how did you get that? I'm actually confused that Dollard wasn't, like, because the message say, I think you need to contact, you should contact Gloria Burgle. And it's like, it didn't say, hey, this is Gloria Burgle, please call me. It did say, it was written in such a way where I don't know why he just immediately assumed she was the one that sent it to him. But maybe it's because, well, of course, it would be someone of law enforcement. I don't know. Whatever. You know, this. We're not saying this is the best IRS guy in the world. Who knows?
I don't know. He might be the best IRS guy in the world, considering we're going to talk about his literal paper trail all around the course of that conference. Yeah. Maybe his brain was just so fried from all the stuff that he was analyzing that he was like, oh, I guess I have to call Gloria Burgle. I'm assuming that Gloria Burgle was the one who sent it and said it in the third person.
That's true. He did have quite the setup there. He did have this broken down pretty well. Okay, so let's obviously we get to see Nikki and Wrench are getting ready for a big battle, and right before they call Varga, we get to see that after Emmett signs these papers, he comes up with this plan, Mike, that he's going to steal Mima's gun. And I understand he was pissed about what, you know, Varga, the reference that he calls him basically the lower animal, is essentially food. I understand. I mean, it's like, okay, that's what's causing you to do something rash, like grab a gun. You got a room full of his thugs with tons of weapons on them. I don't know why he thinks this is a good idea, like that he's going to get this gun and then what? I mean, is he going to shoot everybody? I mean, they're not just going to give you this papers back, buddy. This is what this whole thing was about for them. Just poor Emmett. This guy. Oh, man. And then to watch Varga just convince him that it was a gun with fingerprint. And I understand. I believe that is a real thing, and maybe some of our listeners can tell us. But I don't know. It was just, oh, man, the whole collection. But I'm sure you've got many things you maybe want to say about this. But what do you think about Emmett's plan here to try to get those papers back?
I think it's very indicative that Emmett says, you know, once we cut to after he signed the papers, Emmett just mutters, you know, that he's so tired. And I think that's honestly what it comes down to, is that only is he probably physically tired, you know, he just went through this big ordeal where he thought he was going to go to jail. He is just so tired of the situation that he's put in. So it's sort of just like out of a moment of desperation. Like you said, maybe the food comment was sort of the last straw. I'm inclined to not believe that the gun had, you know, a finger handprint sensor on it.
Yeah, I agree.
I think by the end of all of this, I've just been led to believe that VM Varga, everything he says is a lie.
Yes.
Including him talking about this idea about how, like, wealth was initially about how much you could carry until the Medicis came along and invented banks. And he talks about technology. I think it's been talked about amongst, like, comments about the season as well as to whether, you know, Varga is almost, I don't know if I want to use the term superhuman, but this idea that, like, he's almost infallible, like Malvo was for a good portion of season one, just this, like, almost other human being. A lot of people were comparing him to, like, almost the devil, very Faustian, and saying, you know, hey, I can tempt you with this idea of wealth. And as a result, right, he almost looks like more of an over-the-top caricature than an actual person. So as we're sort of breaking down this episode, I just want to assume that everything that comes out of his mouth is not true, including this idea that, you know, there's a fingerprint sensor on the gun. So even if Emmett tried to fire it, which Varga knew he wouldn't, since Mima was sticking up behind him anyway, it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, but, you know, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think everyone that's watching the show by this time knows that anything and everything this man says is false. But, you know, a lot of these things that he says, I really do believe in his mind, he does believe this is true, which also goes very nicely with the overall theme about truth. Because I've said this many times in real life, is that, you know, if someone believes their lies so much, it becomes truth to them. And, you know, for him, he's got a lot of these things in his mind that he's, you know, believes with his soul that it's real, even though it's not. You know, kind of like in his mind, you know, we never did go to the moon, or you know, no one ever landed on the moon. But that's because that's what he believes. And this guy, he's got a million of them, doesn't he? he's something
else. We've heard close to a million of them, and we'll We are in no short supply, even though Vargas sometimes gets backed into a corner a couple of times this episode. We are not short of the BS that was spewing out of Vargas' mouth, like Rocky Road ice cream that he was eating on the toilet.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Rocky Road. Sorry. I always think of the Goonies when I hear Rocky Road, but we'll just move on. So during this whole episode with Emmett, Varga does get a phone call from Nikki and gives him a place to meet at. And that's when we move into this scene, Mike, where we get to finally all this hard work that Nikki and Mr. Wrench has been working on to get their revenge on Varga and his men. We get to see this thing play out. And I will admit, I thought it was pretty awesome the way the whole thing goes down. I mean, we see them show up. It looked to me kind of like an industrial area of part of town, maybe. It looked, you know what I'm saying? There's a lot of factories. I mean, it didn't look like it was a residential too much, although I'm sure there was homes nearby. This young boy shows up who's speaking mostly, you know, Spanish from what I can, you know, tell. And he leads them to King Midway Storage Building. Now, when I first saw the storage building, I immediately thought of the Widow Govar. Because, right, her whole family has, her and her husband's business, I mean, was storage units, if I remember right, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I believe it was actually called the King Midas storage facility, which King Midas is the, you know, the ancient Greek myth about this king who was given the power of where anything he touched turned to gold. And maybe that's sort of, you know, Varga's conceit is that he feels like he's able to manipulate anyone, that anything he does touch turns to gold, and it essentially dies in a way, as we'll see with the Stussy Corporation. I also thought for a second, going back to like another season one connection as we're about to do with Mr. Wrench, I thought for some reason that Stavros, the Oliver Platt character from season one, had owned a chain of like King Midas something, but I don't think that was the case. But maybe, so I don't think it has any connotation outside of the immediate meeting of King Midas.
Yeah, and I confess to you before we started the podcast that my 24 hours here has been so crazy busy. I haven't done a lot of research, so I didn't know if anybody had brought that up, like with the connection there that it wind up being a storage unit, and if there had been some connections, whether it's in the Fargo universe or had something to do with Goldfar. I mean, I don't think it did, but it would have, you know, it makes sense. But it was, you know, it's very well done. So anyway, the guys are instructed. They get there. Everything. They're taking as much precaution, obviously, as possible. They're instructed to go to the third floor to units 327. There's two elevators, right? Varga and Mimo go up in one with a couple other guys, and the rest of them go in the other one. And by the way, we're going to talk a lot about lighting and stuff, but I loved the focus on the lighting for Varga as they were going up in the elevator, where it kind of the light was already flickering, and of course it worked perfectly with the ending shot too of the light completely going out on Varga's face. But you could tell during this entire thing, Mike, Mimo said this is a bad idea, and I think Varga knows it's a bad idea, but he needs these drives so bad he's willing to take a huge risk. And that's exactly what they're doing, because they're obviously walking right into a trap.
Yeah, I mean, we talked the past couple episodes about this idea that, you know, is Varga starting to have the veneers wear down a little bit? You know, we had this scene with him and Nikki last week where she's able to get the one up on him and has, you know, Mr. Wrench nearly shoot Mimo. He comes up with this proposition of like, oh, maybe Nikki, you know, ran away. It's clear that he's really counting her out, and this might be another one where again he's saying like, oh yeah, well I'll bring these guys, I'll charge in. I know you pointed out the lighting, the cinematography of this entire episode was stunning, but I really want to highlight this scene, because first you have this fantastic slow motion shot of Varga and a bunch of his men and all these, this caravan of cars following this one young boy as they walk into King Midas, and you mentioned the elevator as well. But I think it also shows that, you know, once Varga gets put in that fight or flight response mode, he's very much the latter, where he ends up, you know, spurning his own men, including one of his closest confidants, in order to save his own skin, which he eventually sheds.
Right. And I'm not surprised by that. He definitely strikes me as the guy where if he has a way to save himself, he's not going to worry about anyone, including someone he's really close with. I mean, this is a guy who looks like the lone wolf. He is our wolf in the story, right? it did not surprise me at all that he was not going to hold that elevator open for Mimo or any of those guys. Yeah, so obviously this was a trap. You know, they get up there. You could tell that, you know, we had, of course, the wonderful music by Jeff Russo leading, you know, giving us the feeling that we needed for this scene was just wonderful done. You know, you knew that once they as soon as Varga gets the text message and stuff, and then the other door starts to open, you know things are not going to go well here for anyone who is outside of the elevator. Mm-hmm. I did love Varga's face, by the way. When the door, just as he closed, he had this winch in his face, like, ooh, yeah, that sucks.
Yeah.
As you're hearing the gunfire and the men screaming. It was beautiful.
It's tough. And, you know, again, Varga sent Yuri after Nikki, presumably, just because he adamantly wanted to pursue her and lost him as a result. So, again, Varga is ruthless about getting what he wants, even if it means, you know, sacrificing his men. I know that there were some people online that said we do get a shot eventually of, like, Mimo being put on a stretcher. I don't know if he was dead or alive. I'm going to say RIP Mimo, because I think, you know, even though he had his upper half sort of exposed to the environment, he wasn't zipped up in a body bag.
Yeah.
I like to think that he didn't necessarily survive this, right?
Yeah, I know, absolutely. I mean, I don't even know if I want to dig down that road. As far as I'm concerned, everyone that was left up there was killed by the hands of Mr. Wrench, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, okay, yes, maybe he was on the stretcher. That if, for those of you who want to believe that he lives on, that's great. Maybe, who knows, maybe the doctors were able to get to him in time. It's hard to say. I think one of the first questions you have when you see the scene is, who is text messaging Mr. Varga about the IRS? I mean, you're thinking, oh, is this, was it Nikki? No, it can't be Nikki. Was it Miss Goldfarb? I mean, I don't know how you felt about that. What did you think?
This is another one of those big questions where there really is no right answer. I'm just going to throw out some random guesses here. I know that in hit the conversation with Gloria at the end of the episode, Varga is going to say that, like, or I think Dollard even says in one scene with Gloria when they're breaking down things, he says that, like, oh yeah, we tried to get him once before, but, you know, my higher up stopped the investigation. I think it's very possible that Varga has some sort of confidant in the FBI and the IRS who would warn him of an impending investigation. So that's probably my best guess, that to someone who decided to anonymously tip him off as to what was going on and cause Varga to immediately realize it was a trap and flee the scene.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. I think it's another party that we're not familiar with, because later on when we do get to see the widow Goldfarb, it didn't seem like she had an inkling that the IRS knew what was going on. So I don't think she was the one, but that was the first person that popped in my head, because obviously it didn't make sense for Nikki to tip him off unless she wanted him to go down right away. But that didn't, I don't know. I think she would have preferred him to battle it out with Wrench. And then if he did survive, she was waiting at the bottom for him. Which, of course, we know he never makes it to the bottom because he was able to sneak out the top. Slick move, by the way. Not quite sure if I understand why they didn't. I mean, because how far could he have gotten? I really feel like they still could have gotten him out if they wanted to get him.
Well, I mean, if they were really looking for him. But, I mean, I think we're going to talk about a couple of other possible leaps in logic that occur throughout the course of this episode, which goes back to this idea that, at the end of the day, this is a story. And I think Noah Hawley, this season in particular, really leaned into these more fantastical, non-realistic elements that exist within this environment. So I'm actually fine sort of believing the idea in this frame of a story that Varga was able to take off his jacket and, I don't know, shimmy up the elevator shaft for however many floors, and maybe he escaped down the fire escape or something.
Yeah, yeah. And I do think that when we see Wrench and Nikki together there, as she's, you know, giving him the money and basically they're parting ways at this point, she pretty much tells him that, you know, at this point, I just care about the brother. So I think for her, I guess knocking off Varga would have just been icing on the cake for her. Although,
yeah,
you would,
I mean,
I don't know. It just kind of surprised me. I felt like she really, maybe she just was also assuming that the IRS was going to take him down and that was going to be how she was going to make him suffer, is that, oh, you can go ahead and run, buddy, but the IRS is going to be all over you.
I agree with you. I think from her point of view, and we're going to talk, I think, about how maybe her pursuing Emmett was not the best way to use Ray Wise's words.
Right.
Ray Wise's wise words. But I think I agree with you that, like, once he escaped, she's not like, oh, I have to go after Varga again. Maybe she feels like, well, I took out all of his men. At the same time, I anonymously tipped off the IRS to investigate him. I think he's cornered. Let me focus on the real matter at hand, which, again, I think is going to kind of be her undoing here.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And we will definitely dig in that here in just a minute. Emmett, of course, awakes to find an empty house and the stamp stuck to his head. Obviously, everyone is probably guessing who put the stamp in. To me, the only thing that makes sense is Nikki, because I think she had to go back, of course, to do whatever she did to the car. So I think that she went there, you know, fixed up his car, saw he was unconscious, and thought it would be a funny joke to put the stamp on his head.
Yeah. And
or, you know, a sign for her.
And I think another one of the big questions that we have is, we still don't know, you know, who glued the mustache onto Emmett's face, who hung up pictures of the sign. I think you can assume that it's Nikki and Wrench, considering how covert they've been this entire time as we progress through the 3 months. But in a larger sense, you know, I feel like since we're working with such holistic forces, with Ray Wise as possibly God and Varga as possibly the devil, it could just be like the universe in general, just sure. Like, you know, taunting him. We'll talk a little bit later about, you know, how I feel like the universe was really testing or punishing Emmett until a moment when it suddenly doesn't. But this could be an example of that if you're not looking at the literal interpretation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, poor Emmett rushes back to the office, and he...
I do want to mention, really quickly.
Yeah, please do.
Him doing away with the stamp, I think, is actually pretty symbolic, because let's remember, this whole set of events was put in motion in the very first episode because of the stamp. That's why, you know, Ray and Nikki came up with this plan to send Maurice to get the stamp, and he runs into Anastasi accidentally, and that gets Gloria involved. And to have him suddenly just throw it away, I think is very representative of the fact that we are so past that. You know, this has definitely not become a story of the brothers anymore. This is much larger become a story about, like, these two essential truths butting up against each other. So I thought that was just a nice, small but really significant moment of the finale.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I did think that too. I loved the shot where it's just laying there on the ground, completely discarded, like it means nothing now. And it just shows you, like I said, how far we've come with this story, where it's a lot more than just about that stupid stamp. Emmett was just the look on his face when he saw it. It's like, God, I hate this thing. And he just, yeah. Because in a way, you know, it represents everything that he's lost, and just how his life has just been just thrown into turmoil over this everything. So it was a beautiful, beautiful way to end the whole stamp story, I thought.
Yeah. So that was a nice, again, small throw to the fact of how far we've come, what this was all started over, and, you know, how the stakes are much, much bigger than a 2-cent stamp now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we get to the office, and we get to learn that, hey, look at that. The widow Goldfarb was involved the entire time and has officially taken over the former Stussy Corporation, and she's moving right in, and she was able to get all the assets sold to her for a generous price of $100,000, which, very nice of Emmett, by the way, really nice of him.
Yeah, so I guess, you called it right here, Jeremiah, because I know you had said from, like, the second half of this season, there's something going on with Goldfarb, and I think we got this answer in the finale.
Yes.
It's she definitely was working for Varga. I think, you know, despite Sai from the very beginning setting up this meeting with her, it's very clear that she was sort of a plant to keep leading Emmett and Sai down this certain path. And also she serves as a great sort of, if we're going along with Varga's usual plan of acquire a company, bleed it dry, and then move on to the next body to sort of suck the lifeblood out of, I think using Goldfarb is a great way to do it, because, again, she has relatively clean hands in all this. And I just love the subtle change in wardrobe as well, because let's remember at dinner, you know, dinner's a different setting, but I feel like she's dressed very differently from where she is now, with the, like, Steve Jobs turtleneck and the blazer and the glasses.
Yeah, exactly. I felt like this was the more professional side. Like, this is the more cutthroat business side of her. is kind of what I felt with that. With, like you said, with the glasses and hair pulled back. Like, she's there. She means business. Yeah, to her, this was a big opportunity for her. And Varg obviously has done this more times than we could probably count. So he's used to this, and he was wise enough to see her as a person that she could utilize to make this thing happen. And of course, for her, she benefits so greatly from this whole deal. And yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense once you find out all the details, what's going on. But I could not help but feel just so bad for Emmett at this point. Did you feel bad for him? Because I really did. I mean, we knew it was we knew this was all coming, but man, poor guy. He really, he talks about it later on when he's with Nikki, but he really is at the lowest of low.
And they're right on the nose with the company now being named Realignment, in that Emmett's life has really been realigned. If we're going back to like how far we've come, considering where the Stussy Corporation was and what Emmett's position in the Stussy Corporation was to where we are now, are two completely different settings.
Yeah, exactly. Completely different settings. But, you know, she mentioned it. I mean, when she's had all of her meetings and stuff with Cy and Emmett, you know, she talks about, you know, like, whether or not she really wanted to be in the parking lot business, but I think she just likes the idea of maybe even kind of having them out of the way. But yeah, this is just works out so nicely for her. But yeah, I felt for Emmett, and she was so kind, by the way, Mike, to give him advice about how you should go immediately and file for bankruptcy. But don't worry, all that money you profited is safely hidden away in those offshore accounts. So
yeah, that's what Emmett cares about, his $20 million. I mean, he's gonna utilize it definitely once we cut ahead to 5 years, but I think that's the last thing he wants to think about
now. Yeah, it's the last thing in his mind. The devastation, it was just all over him. It was just so tough to watch, but I just think she was just so calm about, oh, I know, this is a tough time for you, isn't it? I was just... It was so beautifully done. I feel bad for him, but I couldn't help but laugh all at the same time a little bit too. And it worked out great. It's moved right into the next scene too, where basically we get to hear Dollar really explain everything about what's going on and break down from what he gathered, like you said, from his amazing work there he did. For essentially, I would say, do you think he did that overnight? I mean, how long do you think he was working on this? Because he had everything all spread out, and he had it broken down. He knew exactly what was going on. It was very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so, right? Because last episode, we saw Emmett get picked up by Varga, and I feel like Varga wouldn't wait a day to have Emmett sign those papers. So yeah, I guess it happened the same day. I think LaRue Dollard, we sort of, you know, played him off as sort of a non-entity, especially after Mimo kind of scared him away. But he has definitely proven his worth here. But it's so interesting when he's explaining these things, because what he vocalizes is the fact that technically what they're doing is immoral, but not illegal.
Right.
Which, again, one of the core tenets of Fargo is really this idea of morality and the fact that, you know, even though they're doing immoral things, they technically couldn't be punished by a court of law unless they were doing something illegal as well, which they happened to be doing with the tax evasion. But I thought it was super interesting that, again, it's another situation where, you know, they're doing something bad, but because of a story that is being spun this time through like the American law system, they would be able to get away scot-free should they be put in a court of trial.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like this because it works nicely. We've kind of looked a lot into society so much, not only in this season, but, you know, maybe the show overall, and how there's a lot of things that just makes you scratch your head. And these are the kind of examples of things that brings up great conversations about how sometimes the world seems so crooked in a way that how can, you know, these kind of things happen? But they do happen all the time. And like you said, if they would have done things right when it comes to the taxes, technically they would have had nothing against them. So they could have completely done this without anything. I mean, despite the fact that, of course, we know that Varg and his men killed the lawyer, killed other people in the process to make this happen. So there's those kind of laws they were breaking as well, but, you know, they have to be able to prove them, is you know, to get them on him. But yeah, it's an interesting look. I like to have those conversations sometimes too, because it can, even though they're frustrating, but it is interesting how things, you know, works. And I liked how Dollard kind of explained it. He's like, you know, technically this is kind of legal if it wasn't for the tax problem. So it was interesting to look at it. Yeah, I was impressed with his work. He's quite a guy, even though in the end, it only resulted in a 2-year probation. And Vargo was able, of course, to get off scot-free somehow. But I, it was fascinating. And of course, now Winnie, of course, calls Gloria and about the whole storage unit. And they find out that Nikki obviously is the one behind all the scenes. So all the pieces are getting together to find out who is behind all this, and it's Nikki. Badass Nikki Swango. And I think it was almost impressed with her a little bit there. I don't know if they were or not, but it felt like maybe it's the way they were talking about her there on the street. But yeah, so they know that that's their lady. That's who's behind all this.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me that, you know, Gloria has talked with Nikki. She's talked with Emmett. I think she's really tried to sympathize with them both. But the one that she goes to warn is Emmett, because, you know, I think she assumes that, oh, this is who Nikki is going to go after, because, you know, Emmett admits to killing Ray. She's going along with that story, not the one that Varga provides about this guy who falsely turned himself in. So she knows that he's in trouble. Her instincts are correct, but unfortunately, unlike her answering the phone at the very beginning, her timing's off.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate thing, because we do get to see right away, Nikki doesn't waste any time. She's all over Emmett. So, you know, Gloria was right to be worried about him. But don't worry, Emmett finds a way with his stupidity to get out of things and eventually causes other people to lose their lives. Mike, what did you think about how this all plays out? You know, he gets there, his car, of course, stalls. As soon as I saw that stretch of road, I always think of Fargo. Of course, normally I think of that stretch of road being full of snow, but I know that these, you know, each season has been in the different parts of either the Minnesota Fargo area, and of course the movie takes place a lot in North Dakota. So it's obviously not necessarily the same stretch of road, but immediately as soon as you see that shot, you feel like, yeah, this is Fargo.
And you feel like something significant is going to happen. And it does, because let's talk about it here. I think, you know, people are wondering, Nikki is given almost superhuman, you know, tactical skills and smarts and strategic knowledge the past couple of episodes. One would assume once she kind of gets this mission from Ray Wise, as I talked about before, she really outsmarts Varga. She's able to get dispatch of all of his men previously. And people are wondering, you know, how could she succumb to, you know, dying from one cop's bullet without exacting her revenge? And my thought is that when Ray Wise sent her on a mission to really, you know, be vindictive and take down the Wicked, I think he was speaking about Varga. Nikki might have misinterpreted his words and gone after Emmett, who she really wanted to get retribution for. This is her being honestly a little selfish in saying that, you killed Ray. I want you to be at your lowest point. I want you to feel pain and suffering like I did. But if we're going back to this literal holistic example, that was not the instruction that she was given. And as a result, her superpowers, if you will, kind of fade away. So when the cop does show up, she gets in the crossfire.
Absolutely. I like this. And I think it really is dead on, because she took this personal. To her, you know, she's losing sight of who the evil is. And it's not necessarily Emmett in this particular instance. It was Varga. And instead of making sure, like I said earlier, making sure that they took him out, she wanted the brother. And that was a mistake. I mean, and you're right. That is not Paul's message was for. I totally agree with that. And I do believe maybe she would be alive if it wasn't for that. Of course, she'd definitely be alive if it wasn't for Emmett trying so subtly to tell the officer she's got a gun. Oh, man. I wasn't sure if Nikki was going to die in the process as well, leading up to the shooting. But I knew that poor officer was a goner.
Yeah, I mean, and is this, I know we usually have like at least one cop die every season on Fargo. It seems right. like in the finale, we finally get our cop death, and it's some sort of red shirt, even though I don't think he was wearing a red uniform. But
he's marooned, I mean, if I remember right. Or was it his pants? Maybe his
pants. But that's, and that's the fun thing as well, though, is, you know, the criminal who really, Nikki has not been completely pristine this entire season. Let's remember, she ended the first episode by dropping an air conditioner on somebody, flat out murdering him.
Yeah.
You know, to have the hardened criminal go down via a cop's bullet, granted not through the circumstances than we would initially think on paper, is fun to think about.
It is, yeah, it is fun to think about. And yeah, I think we kind of lose sight because I got caught up in Nikki, the character, because she was so great. And I think we talked about this in our last podcast. Nikki really has shined as my favorite from this season. I enjoyed mm-hmm. watching her immensely. But I did almost forget until this scene that, like you said, she is kind of a ruthless person. I mean, you're right. She has no problems killing someone, and she proved it right there. She was ready to shoot that officer if that's what's needed. I mean, yeah, when the officer pulled up, you could tell she's like, ah, crap, you know? I mean, not just because it was ruining her moment, but I think that she probably didn't want to get more blood on her hands, but now she was willing to do so if she had to. And in the end, guys, you know, Nikki is a bad person. She's not a great person.
Yeah, she's just a bad person on a mission. And I will say, going back to cinematography, these crossfades, once the police show up, oh, they were gorgeous, especially yeah. since, you know, they did a lot of these crossfades with all these police investigating, but the camera just slowly zooms in on Gloria. You just get Gloria's simple line of, okay, then. And yeah. I know that it's a moment of dark comedy. I know Brendan Fitzpatrick in particular absolutely loved that line, but
I did too.
I feel so frustrated for Gloria, though, because even though she has had a lot of personal growth at the end of the last episode, this is sort of the equivalent of in episode 3 when she found that box in her hotel room where you press a switch, a hand comes back and flips the switch back and shuts
right.
the box off.
Yeah.
That's basically what happened here. It seems like mm-hmm. this is yet another trail. She was invigorated again to say, okay, it's Nikki Swango. I need to go after her. Oh, Nikki's dead. Great. The trail's cold again. She won't pursue it for another 5 years. And we're going to get, you know, next scene will be her last scene in this timeline. But mm-hmm. I think while it is funny, it's a little sad at the same time in true Coen Brothers fashion, in that Gloria was once again trying to do the good thing, being the Mimsky, saying, I can help. But unfortunately, she was not able to help.
Yeah, that was her story. I mean, she is Mimsky the robot. She's all season long. She was basically one step behind from actually being able to help anybody. She was always too late. And that's her story. And that's just how it is. We do, you know, I do want, before we move, let's talk about this, you know, final scene of her in 2011. I did want to say, so are you satisfied with Nikki's ending?
See, at first I thought no, right? Because again, in the previous Fargo circumstances that we've been given, we want Nikki to sort of get some sort of vindication. She didn't end up killing Varga. She didn't end up killing Emmett. So you'd say like, oh, she died, you know, an unfulfilled legacy. But the more I thought about it, A, if we're attributing this to more of the nihilistic No Country for Old Men type of Coen Brothers ending where people didn't necessarily get happy endings. And also this idea that, as I mentioned before, she was given a direct message to send, but mm-hmm. she decided to pursue the more selfish means, put the blinders on and send it to the wrong person and paid as a result. I do feel like that's a little poetic.
Yeah.
I love the character, like you said, Jeremiah, and I would love to see her get a better ending. But I do feel like there is some meaning in her death here as it pertains to the message that she was given. It's not just another like, oh, random death, then she wasn't able to do anything. There actually is a reason why it happened.
Yeah, actually, and you were able to articulate that perfectly. That the reason why this ending is satisfying and the correct one for her is because she missed the mark from her message. She took things personally, and this makes her death like this feel correct to me. So I agree with you, and we, you know, rest in peace, Swango. We loved watching you. You're a lot of fun, but you know, you screwed up just like everybody else there in the end, and it cost you. And I think, I do think you're right. I think your initial reaction when she got shot in the head, you're like, oh, crap, you know, I was the same way. But then after you stop and think about it, you go, Yeah, you know what though? She kind of deserved that. Yeah.
And
that
also,
was about right.
And this also shows that, you know, even though she has been given this, you know, mission or this new sense of purpose to be kind of a selfless person, she really is, you know, herself at the end of the day, as we mentioned. She's not necessarily a good person. And as a result, she still has these sort of primal instincts for revenge that's going to end up driving her down the wrong path. She veers left when she should have veered right.
Yeah, exactly. And the only other thing I'm confused about is what exactly she did to that car to where it would stall, but then able to start up again later on. I know we had someone from Twitter, MovieFan723, that asked that too. How did Stussy's car start again? Might have been a little convenient writing there, you know, where all of a sudden it started up again. But no surprise that Emmett is like, I'm out of here.
Yeah, and that goes back to sort of what I was saying before with, I think there are certain elements of this episode where the universe is kind of punishing Emmett, and maybe Nikki's death was sort of a way for the clouds to open, whether it be Ray Wise or somebody else to tell Emmett, like, okay, you suffered enough, you're good to go. And I think, again, the next scene we're going to see Emmett doing is him, like, throwing himself at the knees of his wife, essentially saying, like, you need to help me, please accept me back into your life so I get some sense of normalcy back. And it does. I think that might be the last straw for Emmett, where, you know, maybe the world is giving him a momentary respite and saying, like, all right, you're good. We've thrown enough in your direction for quite some time.
Yeah, absolutely. And not to gloss over it, I mean, we kind of talked a little bit about it. I mean, the scene with Nathan, it was a nice moment. I like how she, you know, she wanted to kind of talk about her son, about, you know, the violence of the world and how there's just a lot of things that happened that we can't explain. And I thought it was really well done. I love that line. So for now, just know that sometimes the world doesn't make a lot of sense, but how we get through it is we stick together. And you had mentioned that earlier. I love that line. It was a great moment between the two of them. Especially noteworthy that it was the last one that we get to see them as together. So I liked it. Was there anything that we need to maybe add to that to this conversation, or do you think we kind of already covered quite a bit of that?
Yeah, I think we're okay with it. I mean, I think we're going to get these two obvious big philosophies at the end with Varga versus Gloria. This is sort of Gloria's topic statement of her saying, you know, it's all about our connections, where I think Varga is more about, like, humans are, you know, born alone, we die alone, we live alone. So again, these two philosophies sort of butting up against each other. I'm trying to remember.
That sounds like Don Draper's philosophy.
Yeah, that's very true. I feel like I'm giving a sales pitch right now to the listeners. I do want to briefly mention randomly, what is this, like, March or April? Is this too early for popsicle season, Jeremiah, or is there no limit on when you can eat a popsicle?
I think if you're a fan of popsicles, I think any time, I guess, is fine. I mean, it, you know, when you live in that part of the world, they only get warm weather for a short spell compared to the rest of us, especially where I'm living now. But yeah, it's cold so much of the year. I guess they're ready to jump in just the slightest warm temperatures, you know, because there's no snow on the ground or very little at that time, if I remember right. I'm trying to remember the scene completely in my head. I think any time is fine. They apparently love them.
Well, you know, it's a great mother-son activity, and it's very wholesome, which, you know, this is another point of the scene, is that Gloria says, like, I don't want to corrupt you, Nathan, but this is the way the world works. You know, they even talk in the beginning of the scene about how she's like, you know, I think I'm finally ready to sort of talk to you about Anastasi. And he's like, well, he's not my grandpa, which, again, is a nice reversal from, like, the second episode when, you know, she's saying, he's not your grandpa, don't be emotionally attached to his death. Now things have sort of come and from a 180 perspective. Mm-hmm. So it shows again how things have changed a little bit. Nathan is someone who I felt like if we'd gotten to know Gloria a little more, we might get to know him a little more. I don't know if he's really representative of, like, the naivete of youth. I don't want to go that far, but I thought it was a nice scene between the two. And again, this is the last scene we'll see of Gloria before she joins the DHS. So we're saying goodbye to Gloria in 2011 right here.
Yeah, which, of course, we didn't know it at the time. And we move right. I mean, it happened so quickly because, like you said, we see Emmett drives to wherever his wife is staying, I guess with family, and sobs completely, begs for her to come back. And then we jump into 5 years later. And we not only do we jump 5 years, but we actually get a complete breakdown of exactly what happened to Emmett, at least, in these 5 years. Were you a little surprised that we were able to get this breakdown?
Yeah, this felt a little disparate to me. And again, I've been willing to throw out some rules of reality in this episode in particular, because that's what this season in particular has really set up in terms of a framework. But I don't know how I felt to sort of have like an Animal House-esque text show up saying like, this is what happened just for Emmett 15 minutes before the episode ends. Part of me feels like, you know, maybe there were a couple lines that were going to describe what happened from an exposition perspective that were cut out for some strange reason. But it felt a little strange to me to suddenly have Tex show up saying this is what happened to Emmett. And Tex never shows up on the screen for any other character at any other point in time over the course of this episode.
Yeah, because I think creatively, Mike, we don't need this. I mean, if they would have just showed us what we were able to see here, that they're all together at dinner, and you see who's at the table. Then, of course, what we see from the pictures on the refrigerator. I don't necessarily needed to know that he did file for bankruptcy, that he, you know, was pleaded guilty misdemeanor for tax fraud and was placed on 2 years probation. And that, yeah, it looks like from what we know, the $20 million is still in offshore accounts. I don't think I necessarily needed them to spell that out to me. So I was a little surprised by that, because for a show like this, I feel like this is the kind of writers who would prefer to just show us a beautiful visual of what's going on, and that's enough for us to fill in the blanks that, you know, hey, Emmett has been able to live the last 5 years and things are going well. His life seems to be back in order somewhat. Because we still don't even know what he's been doing the last 5 years. I mean, we know his you know, business was dissolved and all that, and we do know he has this money, so he could have lived off that. But what else has he been doing for the 5 years? We don't know that, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in the end. What matter was is that, you know, he's still alive 5 years later and is about to no longer be alive. I mean, and so really, that's right?
Yeah, well, I wonder if, you know, I think one of the big points of contention with this episode, we're about to talk about his death, as you mentioned, at the hands of Mr. Wrench. I'm sure we'll talk about the logistics of that, but I think people sort of ask from a larger perspective, why kill Emmett off? And maybe what we can talk about it. I think, you know, it's sort of shorthand for saying that, you know, Emmett was able to eventually put this all behind him, and he shouldn't have been able to. Even though, you know, Ray Wise did not send Nikki after Emmett, Nikki in a way kind of sent Wrench after Emmett. And we can talk about like what Mr. Wrench's motivations might have been in coming back 5 years later, especially all like the long period of 5 years later to go after Emmett. But, you know, I think it's very indicative, this moment where he looks at these two pictures on the fridge. It's, you know, him and his wife, him with Cy, and it's him smiling, saying like, well, you know what? We put that all behind us, like he says in his grace speech. Well, at the dinner table, you know, we had our dark moments, but now we're ready to live in the light. And he was able to essentially, even though he really was kind of a patsy and everything with Varga, he was able to get away with it. But unfortunately, while the universe did work in his favor, maybe with the car, it's going to work against him here, where everything kind of, in this case with Emmett, does balance out karmically. And that's what ends up having with him having a bullet in his brain and possibly in the Jell-O salad he was staring at in the fridge.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I wrote, well, because listen, I totally understand that Wrench, I'm sure during his period with Nikki, you know, was able to get close to her. He knew that's what she wanted. She wanted Emmett out of the way. And I totally understand that maybe he would come back and finish the job. I don't understand why it took 5 years, though. That's kind of like a little bit puzzling. Like it's not like this is a few months later, or even a year later. It's 5 years. That's a long time to go. What made Mr. Wrench all of a sudden say, screw it, I'm going and taking him out? I don't know what it is. I mean, later on we hear Varga talking about the pitchforks, the men in the pitchfork. This is one of the things that he had a discussion with Emmett about, how, like, you know, people look at us that are powerful and have money, and they don't like you. They want harm to happen to you because you're successful. And that's true in unfortunately in humanity. I mean, success, there's lots of people who don't like to see success. It maybe because, you know, they've had their own failures in life and they look at people who are successful and like, I hate them. Like, how many times you hear that? Because people say, oh, I just can't stand him. You know, he's got all that money and he likes to show it off. You know, people get rubbed the wrong way. So I don't know if just like all of a sudden over those 5 years, you know, it bothered him that Emmett's still alive and has this money and is still living nicely. I don't know. But something made him want to go ahead and fulfill Nikki's, you know, task that she wanted, even though we all, like we said, it was the wrong one. Emmett was the wrong person. But Mr. Wrench still fulfilled that. And it's interesting that mm-hmm. he did it.
Yeah. I'm wondering, maybe they decided to keep Emmett around for 5 years to have him be the character that shows the passage of time and how things have sort of settled in. Because, yeah, on paper, you think that a really good assassin or mercenary such as Mr. Wrench would not wait a full 5 years unless, sort of like what Malvo does with the dentist occupation, the dentist ruse in season one, he's really waiting for those roots to take seed. You know, he's waiting for Emmett to really get his life back on track, to feel like he's at a high point once again, so we can go out then. I know Nikki wanted him to get as low as possible, but maybe Wrench feels, I want him to suffer the most when he's at, you know, the point where he feels like everything is normal again. Does that need to be 5 years from now? I'm not entirely sure. I don't know what sort of ramifications it will have on, you know, Emmett's family, having him dead right there in the kitchen. I don't know what's going to happen with poor Sai. I'm glad to see he did come out of the coma, though it's very clear there is permanent brain damage, which is really unfortunate. Poor Sai has been dealt so many bad hands, so many bad bridge hands over the course of this season.
Yeah, that's what I wrote too. Poor Sai. You know, I guess he's got money in an offshore account too. I mean, if they're looking at some positive
going to
for
medical
him,
bills.
Probably so. Yeah, I kind of was got the impression he had. Yeah, he had not been out of the coma very, very long, and yeah, he definitely has had some long term effects from it. And I. Oh, poor guy. Well, what are you going to say? That's, you know, it's at least he's alive, you know, and I know that was a bummer for you for your death draft. I mean, it would have been a lot better to have them say, and Sai passed away in the coma, but
nope, he lives. I was waiting for that text to flash onto the screen. I think it's also interesting comparing in each season of Fargo, we really do have these innocent people that for one reason or another, either they turn completely evil or they do evil things with good intentions or they're a complete patsy. And here, you know, if we're comparing the three, we have Lester Nygaard really go full Breaking Bad and end up, you know, dying, trying to take off on a snowmobile across an icy lake. You have Peggy Blomquist, who loses her husband and ends up getting taken away by Lou Salverson. We don't know. I'm assuming she goes to jail, but we don't know exactly what happens. And we have Emmett, who tries to get his life back to normal but ends up still dying as a result. So I think it's interesting to sort of compare the three. Again, we sort of started off in a very familiar place with Fargo, much like the world that Emmett and Sai were used to, but things changed very quickly. But it seems like Emmett had a similar type of ending as those other type of characters in other stories.
Yeah, and do you think Noah Hawley felt like, well, it would have not fit the Fargo mold if he would let him go and get off all after all this time? I mean, I was okay with it because in the end, I do feel like, I've said this many times, that Emmett overall, though, is still not a bad person. And I mm-hmm. felt like that out of all these people that you had mentioned, you know, I could make an argument that this is one guy where I could say, okay, I'm okay with him getting, you know, let's say away with everything, because what, you know, he didn't really do a lot of terrible things.
Yeah, no, I agree that I think, again, of the three people that I just talked about, I think Emmett is definitely the most innocent, or at least the least cognizant of his actions. You know, I feel like the most blood he has on his hands are Ray's, but that's because, you know, he was literally fighting over the picture.
It was an accident.
You know,
let's face it.
Yeah,
it was
an accident. Though, you know, Nikki's still going to blame him, saying that you were the one that let him bleed out onto the carpet. From the way we view things, I think it's a little bit different. I don't know if Emmett could have. I mean, Emmett told Ray to not take the piece of glass out, but he still did. But that's a matter of, you know, her truth versus his truth. But yeah, I mean, I feel like he had to die because I do feel like they needed to set up this final showdown where, you know, we've had Nikki die, we've had Emmett die, we've had Ray die. The only one left is Varga to go up against Gloria. And so I feel like they really need to sort of clear the area to set up this final match.
Yeah. I mean, and would you have been satisfied if Emmett was in prison for tax evasion instead of just getting the 2-year probation? Like, what if they really threw the book at him and got him for some stuff? I mean, would that have been more satisfying if he'd gone to jail? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, maybe, but I also feel like Fargo is not the type of show. Granted, we've talked about how season 3 is different from the previous 2 seasons, but I feel like Fargo overall is a series that deals with finalities, and jail is sort of a temporary medium, right? I feel like,
yeah,
these characters that we're talking about, not a lot of them say like, okay, you're going to jail now. A lot of them die, because I think death is like a nice punctuation point to put at the end of the sentence that describes their arc over the course of the season. So instead of ending with a period, it might have ended with like a little bit of a comma at the end instead of Emma just went to jail. I feel like they, even though you have this weird logic of why wait 5 years, I do feel like killing him off would be a good, again, punctuation point to put at the end of his arc, because it's saying that he was able to think he could get away with it. He was able to live up to Varga's prophecy and get his life back to normal, but he never could escape what happened, and as a result, he died for it.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. If somebody asked me, are you okay? Are you satisfied with him dying? I mean, when you put it that way, I guess I am okay with it. Like I said, it is one character I would have been okay if they would have broken the mold and had him, you know, just live his life off. Because, you know, he still suffered a lot. I mean, he still lost his business. You know, things, I don't know. It's still not going to ever be the same for him. But, yeah, I mean, it does make sense, though, that he would die.
Yeah. I mean, I think it shows that things will never be the same for him, but he was getting things back to pretty much being the same thing. I mean, mm-hmm. even Sai, though he was sort of in a different state, is at his right hand. And so, you know, it's also indicative that a picture of Ray was not on the fridge. So I think Emmett, that was something that Emmett was personally trying to forget. And so that maybe this is, again, him paying for trying to ignore the things that he had experienced and trying to put that behind him. I'm not necessarily advocating completely for it, because I do agree. I'm not really sure why you need to jump ahead 5 years and why Wrench had to wait 5 years from a logistical perspective. But I do feel like there is significance in it, where I can understand why Holly made the decision.
Would you be okay if there was a picture of a cat on the refrigerator?
Or if he decided to adopt Ray the cat.
That would have been perfect. If he would have adopted Ray the cat, then I would not want him to die.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, because, you know, I don't want to leave that cat, you know, fatherless.
No, that would be terrible. Well, let's talk about this final scene a little bit more. I know we kind of dug a little bit into it here and there. We actually have another time jump, technically 3 months, because Gloria does mention how Emmett had died 3 months prior. But apparently, of course, the DHS, who she's now working for, has apprehended Varga, working as an alias as Daniel Rand, as a salesman for accounting software out of Brussels. But he's just a citizen of the air. He doesn't live there, Mike. He is just a citizen of the area. Now, he does try to kind of play it off like he did not recognize Gloria when she comes into the room. Do you feel like he was being honest there? Do you really think he didn't recognize her? I mean, granted, she looked a little different. I mean, her hair is different now. Do you think it's possible that, you know, this guy does, I'm sure, over the last 5 years, who knows what kind of shenanigans he's been involved in? And then prior to that, I mean, this is a man whose whole life, I'm sure, has been a cycle of all these different crazy deals and stuff that he's been doing. He's a very powerful man. We know that.
I don't know. I'd like to assume that he's meticulous enough that he would remember everything that happened, especially if he was so affected by the fact that, you know, this might have been the closest he came to losing his life at the hands of Nikki, that really resonated with him, and he decided to take off for Brussels. I love so much about this scene, just from like a writing perspective and from an acting perspective. Mm-hmm. I will say, even though season 3 is my least favorite season of Fargo, I almost feel like it's my favorite cast, just because like they probably had not the greatest writing across the 3 seasons, but the performances across the board just amplified these characters so much. But, you know, when you have Gloria saying like, you remember me, this is what happened, and Varga just replies with surmise, which, you know, surmise means basically suppose that something is true without having evidence to confirm it, which is basically the entire theme of the Fargo season 3 subtitle should be essentially surmise. I think it's a guise that he's putting up at first before he finally decides to, you know, he mentions Emmett by name. He finally decides to sort of break that wall down, only to build up another one with him talking about, you know, the Russian phrases. And Gloria's just going to keep bursting through every wall he tries to build.
Mm-hmm. She seemed very more confident than we've ever seen. I think really she's grown over those 5 years. Did she come across to you way more confident?
Yeah, I think she's sort of been unhampered by everything around her, essentially. You know, I think when she's in the interrogation room, when she's one-on-one, she's fantastic, but she sort of has been stymied by people like Chief Mo, who really count her out and say, like, well, you can talk to them in there, but I'm the one who makes the decisions at the end of the day. It seems like from when we saw Gloria sort of enter the DHS headquarters, people seem to trust her or seem to vest a little bit of power in her, in that, you know, she comes in and she really owns the room. And that's another thing that makes this scene so great, is that, like, again, we've seen Varga's routine work on nearly everybody except for Nikki, but Gloria is having no nonsense with it whatsoever. He'll say something and she's like, that's not a phrase. And like, and you know, when we have these dualities of her saying, well, you're going to be in Rikers eating mashed potatoes, he says, nope, someone's going to come through and, you know, I'm going to walk off free. She just says, no, you're not. And that is such insistence and confidence on the part of a character that we really haven't seen with Vargo, even from Nikki's perspective. They really made it a fantastic way to end the show. You know, we were waiting for Vargo to kind of get his comeuppance in a way. I think it's debatable whether he actually got his comeuppance, but he's finally encountered someone who's saying, like, no, you know what? You're BS from the beginning. I'm not putting up with anything that you're trying to put out right now.
Yeah. And I mean, we have this great moments between them, the two of them back and forth with this dialogue and everything. And then it does come down to him explaining his truth of what he thinks is going to happen, that, you know, he's even so certain, he says, that the future has already been settled. But yet she's not buying it. She says, you know, no, this is what's going to happen. I guess my question for you is, now that the episode's been over for a little bit, what do you think? Is it Rikers and Snickers, or did Varga get set free?
I mean, Rikers and Snickers is just too good of like a slant rhyme to not pick it. I mean, here's what I will say. I think if we were going along with the general theming of the season, Varga would get away, right? Because as we mentioned before, this definitely seems like a less optimistic version of Fargo. We don't really get these happy endings, so I think it's very likely that Varga could go free and Gloria is stymied once again. But I don't know. I feel like Noah Hawley can't lose that piece of DNA that has him, you know, write these bittersweet happy endings, and she is able to prevail and finally find the setting where she can put him away. I'm an optimist at heart, so I guess that's what I'm inclined to believe, but I love it. I know people hate these sort of ambiguous endings, and this is Carrie Coon is now 2 for 2 on shows this summer in terms of shows that have ambiguous endings. But I love it because back in the LA episode, it's Ray Wise's character who brings up this idea of Schrodinger's cat. This idea that, you know, if you put a cat in a box and you expose it to radiation, if you keep the box closed, the cat is theoretically both alive and dead because you don't exactly know what it is until you open the box. That's sort of the case here at Schrodinger's door. Both Varga's savior and Gloria's savior are technically behind that door until we see who comes through, and we never do. So it almost becomes a paradox in itself, which makes it so much fun and such a different ending from everything we've seen with Fargo so far.
Yeah, and I get this feeling, Mike, by the attitude that I got from Gloria and even her looks there towards the very end, as she kind of is kind of looking and staring at the door herself, is that I got this feeling that she will be, in the end, I think she's going to be okay no matter what the outcome is that comes through that door. But I could be reading that wrong. I mean, obviously she believes in her heart that the right thing is going to happen, that it's going to be the three DHS guys and they're going to take him away, right? I mean, I do believe she feels that exactly what's going to happen this time. But there is this sense of doubt, I feel like, from her body language. But I like to believe that maybe this Gloria Burgle will in the end, be okay with whatever the outcome is. If this douchebag walks away again, I can maybe I'll still go on. I'm still going to go to the fair and celebrate my son's birthday. Life still goes on.
Yeah, that's a super interesting way to look at it. And it almost runs counter to, you know, Emmett saying how life moves on by essentially putting it all behind him. Mm-hmm. Gloria is almost saying, like, in spite of it, we move on. And, you know, I guess I had taken her words to Nathan before sort of a sign from Holly about how things might end on an optimistic note. But maybe, like you said, it's ending on an optimistic note for her, but doesn't mean an optimistic note for the show, in that Varga could still escape, but unlike all the other characters, he has not fazed Gloria. Like you said, there's still chaos in the world, but all that matters to Gloria are the relationships that he has, that she has. And since she has a relationship, presumably with Nathan, maybe even another man in her life, we're not entirely sure. 5 years is a long time. She's going to be completely fine no matter what. I think that's a really interesting way to look at things, where it doesn't even matter who walks through that door. And, you know, Carrie Coon has this really fantastic moment where she just, like, we have this great thing where, you know, Varga gives his truth and, you know, he says, you'll know your place in the world soon enough. And the lights literally go down on him like he's doing a play. And he doesn't, Dave Kulis, I don't know if you noticed, there's a nice, like, little wink at the camera at the very end, almost like a nice bow for the character.
Right.
But Carrie Coon lets out this tiny smirk. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out what that smirk means, whether it's her saying, like, no, I'm right, or whether it's her saying, like, no matter what, my life is fine. Maybe it's the latter.
It could be. And that's what I was wondering, because I did see that smirk, and that's kind of what led me to some of these thoughts was. And it could be either one, but I do wonder if it's the latter. It's interesting. Again, these are just our opinions, but it depends on how you want to interpret that entire scene. But it was a beautiful scene. I thought it was a really nice ending to this season. And I mentioned it too, the lights going out on Varga's face, him saying goodbye and the lights going out. That was great. And even too, I thought it worked nicely if this is the final piece of the Fargo television franchise. That was also nice, just the whole way. I thought it was a really nice way to end it, that's the case.
And a fantastic bookend for the season as well. Mm-hmm. In both the very beginning of the season and the very end, we begin and end with an interrogation.
Yes.
In this case, you know, I think the tables have turned. I think, you know, the interrogation against the man that they think is Yuri Gurka, it's much more of a victimization, whereas here it seems like some of the power is actually vested in the one who's being interrogated, in Varga, and he seems to be the one to really change the narrative, much like the East German government does in the prologue. But I think that was a nice way to bookend things as well. I think one of my main minor quibbles with this season is that I do feel like we sacrificed, even though it really emphasized the storytelling aspect, there we took so many weird twists and turns that it didn't feel like a real cohesive narrative throughout. But maybe this was one example of just an entire arc to see, again, how far we've come from the very beginning, or how cyclical it is that we end up exactly in the same setting that we were at the very beginning of the season.
Yeah, I do feel like it was very intentional. You know, I mean, the other question we got from MovieFan7023 is, does the ending have any connection to the East Berlin interrogation scene? And I think it absolutely does. To me, I felt like it was very intentional. But, I mean, again, I don't know if this is something that maybe Noah Hawley has talked about in some of his interviews. I have not read every one of them, but it did feel that way, and I thought it did bookend this very nicely in the end, because the whole scene means so much to these overall themes that we've had this season, and I thought it really fit in just nicely, just so perfectly. And it's just that's my opinion, but I really did feel that way.
Now, Jeremiah, I know you're a Leftovers fan as well. The great Brendan Fitzpatrick sent us a few questions about the finale, but one of them is, man, Carrie Coon, 2 for 2 with the season finales with ambiguous endings while sitting across from someone at a table with a long monologue. Compare/contrast the two scenes with the two Carrie Coons. What I noticed, maybe again this is me having sort of my Leftovers magnifying glass still on from when I covered this with Jay and Jack, I feel like Carrie was almost in the Varga position during the Leftovers, where she was the one really spinning this narrative. And, yeah, you know, she asked people to believe her in this case. Now, is she nearly as confident and outright slimy about it as Varga? Absolutely not. But I feel like it's interesting to sort of compare her roles in the two, where she's almost sitting at the table opposite from herself, in this case in Fargo.
Yeah, I like that too, Mike. I can't, when you do the comparison, that is one thing that stands out. It is the differences that we have with these two ambiguous endings, because I feel like, you know, and I don't want to get too deep about this, and I certainly don't want to spoil too much, obviously, for those who maybe have not watched the finale of The Leftovers. But I feel like, I still feel like I can trust what she is saying. I can trust her character in The Leftovers more than I can ever trust, obviously, anything that Varga is spewing out. So, you know, even though she's in the Varga role, but I feel like she's a more trusting Varga.
That's a good point. You know, and I feel like, again, I don't want to, if you don't want to hear Leftover stuff, I'd say tune out for the next like 30 seconds to a minute. But I mean, that's also the interesting thing about the Nora Durst stuff that happens at the end of The Leftovers, is that she has been the skeptic the entire time. She's been the person to like never preach a false narrative, if you will. She's always about like, no, this is reality. Here, she does actually take the same standpoint, Gloria Burgle. I feel like Gloria is, again, the only person to stay really grounded in reality and not necessarily, you know, come up with her own version of facts to sort of skew the narrative. So I guess she took that sort of segment of Nora into Gloria Burgle. But I feel like otherwise the storytelling aspects lie with Varga. So I guess if you take the humanity and sincerity out of Nora Durst, you're kind of left with VM Varga.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So it's a great question, and I know a lot of people, I'm sure, was talking about these whole comparisons and stuff. We've said it many times. She had a phenomenal year this year, and I sure hope it shows up in the Emmy Awards this year. I just hope somehow she can get something. I'm not holding my breath, Mike, because I know how these things go, and I understand there is some amazing other female actresses out there that has a great shot at this thing, but it sure would be great to see her win something. That would be awesome.
I'll give you a hot take, Jeremiah. I think she has a much greater chance of being nominated for Fargo than she does for The Leftovers. Because, like you said, especially, you know, assumingly she'd be nominated for Best Actress in a Drama, that is a saturated category at this point. I don't want to talk too much Emmy's politics, but, you know, I think that there is so much great TV out there, especially from a drama perspective, that I feel like that field is very full. I feel like Best Actress or Supporting Actress, even in a miniseries, is a much less competitive field.
Okay.
So I could totally understand if she got nominated there. And maybe even by happenstance, she wins as sort of like also a win for, you know, for The Leftovers. I know the Emmys does weird stuff sometimes where, like, you know, even though a show might not necessarily have a stellar final season, it's still nominated for an Emmy and still wins as sort of like a legacy award of thanks to all you've done for TV. I know that The Leftovers and Fargo are not two of the most highly rated cable shows out there, but maybe there's a chance if she ends up winning, it could be a way of them saying like, hey, we couldn't nominate you for The Leftovers because of all the other stuff going on TV, but we wanted to thank you for all the work you've been doing on TV this season. Again, that's me being optimistic.
Yeah, and the way I'm someone who, I'm award junkie, and I totally agree with you here. I think that it's a very good possibility that she has a good chance because of the fact of the category that they put this show in. I think there's a good possibility we'll at least see a nomination for her, and who knows, maybe she'll win. That would be great.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. And I know that, you know, in terms of timing things, I think, you know, we have the Emmy nominating process now, I believe. So I feel like both shows are nice and fresh on Emmy nominators' minds, that hopefully this does bodes well for both of them, because I've been so lucky to cover two of my favorite shows on TV here on the Jay and Jack Network. And I thought this was a really fun thing to close out. I know Brendan Fitzpatrick had a couple of other questions, Jeremiah. Do we want to get into it as we finish things off here?
Well, I mean, you covered number one. Number two, he was, of course, wanting us to discuss a little bit more about the ending, you know, because, you know, at first he says he was confident that Glory Burgle was right on, that Varga goes to jail. However, while that's more a satisfying ending, is that the correct end for the theme and the tone of the season? You know, his chances, he did walk away free. And we've talked a lot about this, and I kind of fall, Brennan, I fall exactly where you are at. I feel like I want to say she's right in this particular incident finally, but there is that overall feeling that makes me think that maybe he did walk away free because it does fit the theme better.
Mm-hmm.
And what what they've been trying to tell us all season. I do feel like he's a very powerful man, so it would not surprise me at all if that it's that person that she can't argue with that comes to the door and sets him free.
Well, speaking of Varga, I know his third question was rank the big bads of the three seasons. So we've got Malvo, we've got Varga. Who would you say, Jeremiah, is the big bad of season two? Is it Dodd Gerhardt? Is it Mike Milligan?
I think that they would like us to feel like it's... I think they want to feel like it's Dodd.
Okay.
Because... Milligan was kind of a middleman a little bit. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think it should have been more? I don't know.
I feel like also at the end of this, I want to go back and rewatch Fargo season two, because I'll admit that I wasn't as high on season two as I was on season one, but I feel like I've seen a lot of internet-wide appreciation for season two. Some even like season two more than season one.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to go back and rewatch it. Now that we've sort of experienced more supernatural fantastical elements from this season, maybe stuff like, you know, the UFO or the idea that Hansi, you know, undergoes this really radical plastic surgery to be changed into somebody else, maybe we can sort of let that reality go a little more and enjoy it for what it is. But for the sake of brevity, let's go with Malvo, Dodd Gerhardt, and Varga. For me, Malvo is definitively number one. It's tough because like Varga is so two-dimensional. You know, I still don't think we ever really found out what his motivations were, unless he really is this sort of like devil-like character. Unless he just wants to go to like taunt people, it doesn't feel as deep as like Dodd was an ass, but you could at least like understand why he was driven to do what he does. But I love David Thewlis much more than I forgot the actor who played Dodd Gerhardt. So I'm really torn. I'm going to put performance over characterization here and put Varga just squeaking ahead as number two and put Dodd Gerhardt as number three.
Okay. Yeah, I could go with that. I like that. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, Laurel Malvo is always going to be my number one. And I could really go back and forth when it comes to two or three. And like you said, too, also really who is the main antagonist in season two. That also is, your interpretation there, Mr. Fitzpatrick. I mean, I don't know who you feel like is the big bad for season two. It's a good question, Mike. It makes me...
Yeah, it's a good one. I'm going to have to really... So if you want to sound off to us on social media about, you know, who you might think the big bad of season two is, how you might rank things, if you want to, I don't know, rank the cops, too, if you want to rank our, you know, our innocents getting involved in Lester, Peggy, and... Emmett, you can do that too. Now that we sort of have three seasons in the can, we can do a lot more cross comparison between the three. Again, while this was my least favorite season so far, just because of the sort of inconsistencies and maybe the lack of deep characterization until the latter half, I still greatly enjoyed this season, especially the back half. I feel like it absolutely ramped up rather than, you know, having Nikki futz with your truck and having it run out in the middle of the road.
Yeah, I totally agree. You want to cover the last one?
Yeah, so he just made some quick cinematic references here. The room 327 could be a reference to room 237, which is the infamous room from the film version of The Shining. You also have, you know, blood in the elevator. He also said that when Gloria was passing by the cells, it reminded him of Clarice going to meet Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. I didn't really detect any other big, you know, movie references outside of the Coen canon. Did you, Jeremiah?
No, I did not. I mean, I'm glad he asked me that question. Usually I always have those references of a film. But personally, I didn't. The ones he mentioned was dead on. But I did not, unfortunately, Brendan, I didn't have anything else that came to me. Maybe when I watch it again, maybe something else will strike me. But
well, we have one more thing to do here, Jeremiah, to finish up Fargo Season 3. At the very beginning of the season, you and I did a death draft. And for a while, throughout the middle of the season, it looked like I was doing pretty well. You know, Ray had died. Sai looked like he was on death's door, and we had VM and Nikki facing off against each other. You got a point for Nikki killing DJ Qualls, the golem, while she was on the run. And Jeremiah, that's ultimately what got you the win, because by 3-2, you are the winner of the Fargo Season 3 Death Draft. Congratulations,
yes!
Sir.
It's amazing. It's funny, because I wasn't doing all the math in my head while I was watching it, but when that scene happened and she wind up dying as well, I was like, oh, wait a minute, I think this might put me over the top. So I told my wife, I looked at her, I go, honey, I think I might have won the death draft. She goes, she just, you know, sighed and shook her head like, oh boy.
Well, at least you didn't say like, oh, I'm going to call the police because you used the term death draft just randomly off the top of your tongue. I mean, we could even put you even more over the top by saying like, if you want to technically give points to VM or Nikki for all the henchmen that died, it wasn't them directly doing it, but I feel like they were both responsible for it. But either way, you end up winning. It was Sai coming out of that coma that cost me the win. But that
damn you, Sai.
I do get, you know, an emotional win in having Sai be alive, and that's all that matters at the end of the day. But that's congratulations true. To you, sir. It's well deserved.
You can sleep better at night, my friend. So, yeah, I came up there in the end, but yes, I'm expecting that trophy to be sent to my house, along with a prize. I think I heard about a check. Something about a check. Is that true?
Yes, it's a note that says call Gloria Burgle and she'll send you a check.
Oh, okay. All right. I will do that. I don't want to forget here. We did have some questions from Polly on Twitter as well. One of them we did kind of already, I think, elaborated on quite a bit about whether or not Varga continues on. Polly, whatever you feel, my friend.
Yeah.
I definitely go back
to you. That feels like such a cop-out answer, but I also feel like that's purposeful.
Yeah.
I think Holly is saying, like, you believe whatever you want to believe at the end of the day, which, again, compares very similarly to the end of The Leftovers. But I think, you know, we gave our thoughts. You could give your thoughts, and they're both completely right, because I feel like Holly has a right way of how it ended up turning out. So I'd be intrigued to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, Holly. Absolutely, Polly. Hit us up. What do you think? Which truth did you believe in? Which one did you like the best? And, you know, I mentioned I kind of lean towards Brendan Fitzpatrick's way of thinking at the moment, so I think maybe he walked away free. But I like his last questions. What are the odds of Mr. Wrench in a season 4 if it comes?
I don't know if it'd be a Mr. Wrench cameo, because as we said at the very beginning of this podcast, I don't know if Noah Hawley does come back, what timeline and what setting he's working with. But we saw at season 2, the Wrench cameo was just him as like a random little kid playing baseball in like the third to last scene of season 2. So I feel like there will be a Wrench cameo, but when, where, and at what age is still yet to be determined.
I agree. To me, it's a simple answer. If there is a season 4, I think they've already gone down this road. Why not?
Yeah.
Depends on the time frame.
Holly's changed up the bunch in moving from Fargo season 2 to season 3, but I think the one thing he will keep consistent is this random runner of Mr. Wrench now being involved in all three narratives in some way, shape, or form.
I agree 100%. Well, Mike, I think as we're closing out, I don't want to miss out on this opportunity, not only to thank, of course, Brendan Fitzpatrick for all the love we've gotten from him. Of course, in this particular episode, we also got MovieFan723 on Twitter, and Pauly. I just want to thank all of the listeners, though, by the way, for any feedback we got this season, and just for listening and giving us ratings and all of the love we've gotten from everyone. We really appreciate it. We don't know if this is the end of Fargo, obviously. Hopefully not. Maybe if our man Noah Hawley can come up with something brilliant and we can talk about this show again, that'd be great. I'm sure this won't be the end of Mike and I doing things together, maybe here for the Jay and Jack Network. That's always a possibility. We were already in talks about things that maybe me and him can do here for another show, perhaps. You know, we'll find out here as we go on. But I just really enjoyed this season. It's been a lot of fun to talk about this. And, of course, Mike, it would have happened if it wasn't for you, my friend. And it's been a real pleasure to discuss this season with you here on the Jay and Jack Network.
Well, the pleasure was all mine. Again, to fill in a little bit of the history, for those of you that don't know, Jeremiah had done podcasts for season 2 on another network, which I was fortunate enough to join for a few episodes. And I am so lucky that he was willing and able to jump on and cover season 3 for Jay and Jack. This was still, even though people might have their quibbles with this season, this was still so much fun to talk about, so much fun to watch, so much fun to cover. Again, as Jeremiah said, thank you to all the people who listened to the podcast, whether you sent us feedback or just, you know, had us in your earbuds yammering for hours at a time every week. We're appreciative of anyone who contributes to the Jay and Jack Network. Speaking of which, if you're not subscribed yet, make sure you're subscribed to the Jay and Jack whole enchilada feed. That way you're going to get all the great stuff that Jay and Jack is offering. For example, going on in the summer months, we have the broadcast. We have the newly refurbished Ramblecast. We've got the Star Wars podcast, Owen and Baru's Barbecue. In the fall, I know Survivor will start back up. Jay, Jack, and I are working on a Battlestar Galactica podcast idea. So there's so much stuff going on in Jay and Jack with so many fantastic people. Don't miss a second of it. If you want to talk to either one of us about this ending, about the Fargo season, about any other news that might come your way, feel free to reach out to us on Twitter. Jeremiah is at jpanhorst, and I'm at a Mike Bloom type. And again, thank you all for listening. And Jeremiah, thank you for being a fantastic co-host. I would never leave you dying in an elevator as the doors closed in front of me.
I appreciate that, man. It's so beautiful. And you know what? I would never leave you as well. So this has been, it really has been a blast. I appreciate it. And I look forward to hearing maybe some of the fans on Twitter where we can talk a little bit more about Fargo. So hit me up. I'm always talking about television. I'm actually eventually here hoping to maybe get into the adventure land of maybe showing people how to podcast. So if anybody's interested, hit me up on Twitter. I'm trying to make a list of people that might be interested in that as I continue to get that going. But I'm always doing things in the podcasting world, especially when it comes to talking about television, because that's my love, Mike. I love sitting around talking about TV.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know what that says about me, but that's what I like
totally,
to do.
I'm totally there with you. You can find me on a bunch of other networks talking a myriad of shows. I talk Saturday Night Live when it's in season on post-show recaps. I talk a lot of reality television, Survivor, Top Chef, RuPaul's Drag Race. If you're a fan of the written form, I am, and if you're a Survivor fan as well, I am doing exit interviews for Parade Magazine starting with Survivor 35 this fall. So I'm really excited, really nervous to be doing that, to be able to pursue that opportunity. So be sure to check that out if you're into that thing. If this has told us anything, it's that the written word and the stories that we put out are greatly important, and I hope that you check out my version of the truth.
Yeah, you definitely should. It's good stuff. Mike, you're a talented person, and I'm sure our listeners are smart enough to know that that is a media they should check out.
Yeah. Well, thank you again all so much. We hope this is not the end for Fargo, but if it is, what a way to go out. What a fantastic show. Overall, this has just been such amazing television to get to talk about 10 episodes of the 30 episodes of greatness that we've had the past 3 years is absolutely fantastic. And Jeremiah, I have a feeling that we will be talking about something somewhere one day in the future. I'm like Varga. I know where we're going in the future, and I feel like it's going to be someplace nice.
I agree. I like that future, Mike. So until that future comes true, you take care, my friend. Everyone take care, and we will catch you in another life.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.